Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The War at Home, the acclaimed documentary that tells the story of the 1960s anti-war movement in Madison, Wisconsin, has been newly restored. After a successful crowdfunding campaign, the film, which was first released in 1979, is now being shown across the country. The War at Home traces anti-war resistance from protests by University of Wisconsin students to the students' peaceful sit-in against Dow Chemical in 1967 that turned violent. The film does an incredible job of showing the power of resistance, protest, organizing, and direct action. It also raises many questions about media coverage of the war back then and then wars today. We're joined by Glenn Silber, an award-winning filmmaker and broadcast journalist who has produced 90 primetime news magazine stories for various CBS News and ABC News broadcasts, as well as 10 independent documentaries, primarily for PBS. Glenn Silber was twice nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary for The War at Home and El Salvador, Another Vietnam. If you're in the Bay Area, The War at Home is now playing at Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco and Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley. And you can find more information about other screenings across the country at yourcallradio.org. And Glenn Silber joins me in studio. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Congratulations on the newly restored film. It comes out at such a critical time in this country because it just, watching the film, I just kept thinking about media coverage of all of these wars that the U.S. is involved in today.
Well, it's been very different because in Vietnam, of course, that became the TV war, and that was a huge factor of stoking the anti-war movement back home. And then you flash forward to Iraq, where everyone all of a sudden is embedded. Right. I was at ABC News and I declined the offer to be embedded. That wasn't the way I do business. And I thought that was bullshit, frankly.
What happened when you declined the offer?
Oh, it's a longer story. They just put out they put out a memo at 2020 where I was working that asking people if they wanted to get what they called special media training. And they explained that meant it would be if you decided to go over there, how you might survive if you were captured. And, you know, I got a call from a senior producer because I was considered at that point, I think, maybe the most serious producer on 2020 that was always trying to do kind of aggressive things. They thought I'd want to go. But of course, I had two kids in college and I'd been down to El Salvador and I'd done things like that. And the whole thing, I was so against the war in Iraq for months and months. I was actually making not friends by being so outspoken about it. I thought it was bullshit from the beginning, part of my B. But anyway, so I just didn't want any part of it. I wound up doing some important work around the investigation into 9/11 with John Miller. We were the ones who broke the story where the terrorists had been living in Paterson, New Jersey. And, you know, I felt I could do plenty of good things on the ground back home. I didn't have to go over there and be embedded.
That was really big when that came out. Is that still happening, do you know?
Well,
I don't hear about embedded reporters anymore.
Don't forget the ramp up to, I mean, it's so ridiculous, the ramp up to the war in Iraq with this whole question of weapons of mass destruction and signaling to everyone over there that there was going to be shock and awe in a month or whatever it was. The whole thing was strange, and I just thought it was an incredible disaster, and I could see it like a train wreck. So I didn't want to do it.
Well, we'll talk about coverage or the lack of coverage of the wars that the U.S. is currently involved in later in the show. But this film, The War at Home, which was first released in 1979, has been newly restored. Why did you decide to work on this 40 years later?
Well, it's a good question. You know, the film was very successful when we first put it out there. It won some top prizes at important film festivals like Chicago and what was the forerunner to Sundance. And then it was nominated for an Oscar, and it played around the country. It played here at the Surf Theater for a month back in 79 or early 80. But it just felt, in this new context, after when the women's marches happened right after the inauguration, I've been living in Santa Fe the last couple of years, and I didn't really connect with the community that well until the women's march, and I realized, wow, I really do live in a progressive community. So I took the old DVD I had into one of the local cinemas And I said, here's my film about resistance. And that's what we're talking about now. They loved it. We did a test run. It went great. Hmm. So then I found out when I tried to take the film out to New York, they said, well, we'd only run it here if you had it restored in this new format, which I hadn't really heard much about, 4K. So I decided to do it. And over the last year, it's been almost 12 months leading up to tonight's show, we opened in New York, we're at the New York Film Festival with this new version. And what really shocked me when we did our test run in Santa Fe is that the film played stronger than when we first released it. I don't know too many 39-year-old films that can say that. But it felt like it was made for this political moment.
Yep.
And I was thinking after the Women's March, which I was so inspired by, like, what can I do to contribute? Mm. And it turned out to be this. So I'm really proud to have the film here. And I'm even more proud of the fact that in the last couple of weeks that we've shown it, mostly in New York at the festival and afterwards in a commercial theater, people love the film. They really feel not just inspired, but empowered to see the film about when people banded together and over a sustained 8-year period. What is the anti-war movement? It's a sustained resistance movement with one particular goal in mind, to stop the war.
To stop the war. And these students at the University of Wisconsin, they did not relent. I mean, when Robert Kennedy, you have some amazing footage in there.
Not Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy, thank you, yes. Ted Kennedy, I mean, when he came to campus, they got in his face. I mean, and it reminded me of what happens when some of these politicians are going to campuses today.
Well, you know, that was an incident that happened in, I think it was October of 66. And even before that incident, you see some of the key organizers doing some pretty strategic things. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, one of the organizers said, we had announced at the beginning of that school year, we weren't going to let any administration figures show up here and tell us what's going on, because we know what's going on and we don't want to hear it. And so they had a very interesting strategy where it's in a hall that holds, it was actually what we called the Cow Palace, where they had all the, you know, in Wisconsin they have a big dairy thing. It holds about 2,000 people. So they put 30 of their members behind the stage holding signs, but when they screamed to interrupt, the idea was that the microphone on stage would pick up their voices. I mean, who thinks like that? Mm. I would never have had that idea. So there were some really committed organizers, and I think that's one of the takeaways from the film, that you've got this core group of super committed people who are every day thinking and strategizing, how can we get more, in this case, students involved. And through creative tactics, they really created quite a stir. After this interruption of Kennedy's speech, in 66, people were so appalled that a petition went out to apologize to Senator Kennedy. This went on for days and weeks, and it forced people to really analyze their own position on the war.
And I read an interview, pretty lengthy interview you did with Danny Perry. I want to give him credit. And if I remember correctly, initially when you were thinking about doing this film, you also wanted to include footage from other campuses.
Well, that's a good question. When I first wanted to do the film, I went to a man I greatly admired as the father of American political documentaries, Emil D'Antonio, and I thought I was too young. I was only probably 24 at that time. I told him my ideas. He thought they were great. And he said, it's a great, important story. I had hoped he would do it. And he said, but no, you're the one who's got to tell your own story. Mm-hmm. And his overriding piece of advice was, he knew all about the Madison story. He knew about the Dow demonstration and Carl Armstrong and all that. And he said, don't jump around from Berkeley to Columbia University and strike in 68. Don't be a mile wide and an inch deep. Stay focused on Madison. Treat Madison as a microcosm of the period. And that was the best piece of advice. That was our guiding principle throughout making the film.
And you know Madison very well because you went to school there from 1968 to 1972.
Oh, yes. And I also stayed there for the next 7 or 8 years doing different type of media projects until 1975, as the war was really getting ready to come to an end. I fully committed to tell this story.
And what's interesting is I feel like Berkeley gets so much attention. And for people who are familiar, really familiar with movements, they know about Madison. I didn't know much about what went on in Madison. What was it about that school that had such an incredible movement and so many dedicated students?
Yeah, it's like the Berkeley of the Midwest. You know, the Bay Area has always been kind of a culturally radical place. And, of course, the university with the history of the free speech movement and anti-Hueck, which is brilliantly captured by Mark Kitchell's film, Berkeley in the 60s. That came out about 10 years after the war at home. Mm-hmm. Madison was really an interesting place for serious people. We had the strongest history department in the country. They had luminaries like William A. Williams, who wrote The Tragedy of American Diplomacy, and Harvey Goldberg, and these George Moore, these incredible intellects that attracted serious people who were really interested in history. And then when they understood what was going on with the war, didn't just sit in class, they got busy. And so I think that's one of the things. It has a history of progressivism, at least it did until a couple years ago. And I just feel like there were students there that found pretty quickly, apart from the fact that some of the people, like young men, were at risk to go to war because of the draft, I don't really think that was it. I just think it was an intensely political place to begin with, where people, instead of going to maybe an Ivy League school or some other great school out here, they wanted to come to Madison because of the intellectual power of primarily the history department. And then things happened like SDS, and then things happened like administration sit-ins, and then things happened like a two-year campaign against napalm. And what you see in the film is, with every – what's so great about film, I think, when you have a 100-minute film and you're trying to cover 10 years, you can really compress and illustrate that history, because we were very lucky to have all the footage that existed from local TV news. So we were able to do a storyline, then find the footage, and then look at who would be the best people to talk about those events.
And especially in this soundbite culture that we live in, this cable news world that we live in now, to sit back for almost 2 hours, right?
100 minutes.
Yeah, to sit back for that long and to watch all of this play out, it's just so important, especially when you're thinking about historical context.
You know, I've seen the film so many times, and parts of it still move me almost to tears. But what I really get the feeling is, you know, the arc of the film from the beginning, which we have the first anti-war demonstration of more than two people anywhere in Madison, and it's on film. And one of the people who was there talks about it. And by the time the film is coming to an end, you've been through such a kind of emotional roller coaster, and visually it's so gripping, and the characters, I think, the people who talk are just great. You know, I think by the end of it, you're feeling fatigued a little bit, like the movement felt fatigued by the end. Not in a really bad way, but just like, okay, we're going to get this done. Mm. And, of course, the anti-war movement did play a role, a significant role in helping to bring the war to an end. I just want to make one comment that I was really impressed with Ken Burns' 18-hour epic called The Vietnam War that was on PBS. But what I was, and I think it was great, especially because you heard from the Vietnamese at length, which was amazing. But what really kind of blew my mind is that you've got 18 hours of real estate to tell this great story, and something under 5 minutes on the anti-war movement. One person, a friend of mine, Bill Zimmerman, represents the entire anti-war movement. It's kind of ridiculous. And it's such a glaring omission that it helps sort of set the stage, both bringing Vietnam back to the consciousness of Americans, and at the same time, everyone I know was very upset that there was almost no coverage of the anti-war movement. That doesn't make sense.
I haven't seen that, but that was one of the main criticisms, especially right now, that was lacking.
Yeah, well, it works for me.
Today we're joined by award-winning filmmaker Glenn Silber, who also was a broadcast journalist. He produced 90 primetime news magazine stories for various CBS News and ABC News broadcasts. He was twice nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary for El Salvador, Another Vietnam, and for The War at Home, which has been newly restored. If you're in the Bay Area, it is opening tonight. The War at Home is playing at the Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco and Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley, and you can find other theaters across the country at yourcallradio.org. You're going to be at one of these screenings, right?
Oh, yes. I'm going to be tonight speaking. I mentioned Mark Kitchell, who's a friend. He's going to do the Q&As with me after the 7:30 show. And then tomorrow afternoon, I'm going to do a Q&A, which would probably wind up happening after the 2:20 show, maybe around 4 o'clock. But I'm very excited about the Saturday night show, which is going to be at the Shattuck Theater, because Dan Ellsberg and Rick Goldsmith, who made that fantastic film about Dan called The Most Dangerous Man in America, which I just love, that's on Saturday evening. And then lastly, another friend of mine, Connie Fields, who made the film The Life and Times of Rosie the Riveter and other really great films, she's going to be there on Sunday at 4 p.m. show. I love being able to have this dialogue with the audience afterwards, and it's been incredibly moving just to see people who haven't seen the film in 38 years, or some young person who has never seen the film. That's what we're really trying to figure out, how to get the film. It's time for us old guys like me to pass the torch. But to me, this is, like I said, this is my contribution to the resistance, to put this film back out there, to look at how do you build a 7-8 year resistance campaign. What does that take when you're up against presidents like Lyndon Baines Johnson and warmongering presidents like Richard Nixon, who don't even care? Remember when in the film there's a guy who says, after the moratorium, one of the few times we do go outside of Madison, and the guy says, well, you can have 250,000 or 500,000 people protest, and then you hear that Nixon was watching a football game.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to lead to frustration. So all these, the texture of this whole movement from start to finish, you keep seeing the consciousness growing, you keep seeing the resistance growing, and it's just charging ahead and not backing down. So I think the two takeaways, and probably more, is we got to get organized, you got to get informed, you got to get organized, and then you have to really decide if you're going to be, which side are you on?
You know, talking about Johnson and Nixon and the choices they made, I was thinking about the man in the White House, and you have these seminal events happening in the U.S., and he goes to play golf at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, well.
Right?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute. If you have any questions or comments for Glenn, if you saw the war at home, we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to ask Glenn, I mean, he's a longtime journalist. When did you first start doing journalism?
Well, at first, I spent my first 12 years as an independent filmmaker, making films like The War at Home and El Salvador and another Vietnam. And, you know, my wife and I made the film on the San Francisco Mime Troupe here, which is a fabulous film called Troopers. It's an award-winning film because we really, I was always, in a way, back then when I was still in my 20s, early 30s, I sort of looked at the Mime Troupe as kind of doing what I was trying to do. They do it with theater. I was trying to do it with film, which is create a radical culture and tell the truth and use a different form. In this case, they're very entertaining to capture people's attention. And we just loved that year. We had so much fun. And so there were other films. And then it turned out my wife was pregnant the entire year we made Troopers. So that was kind of the end of the independent world. And I got very lucky. I stumbled into the back door of CBS News and ABC for 20 straight years doing really great work, because what my problems as an independent, which every independent will say, money for production and then how do you distribute it? So when I was working for these primetime shows, problem solved. And every piece I would do would be at least maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 million people would see.
Wow.
It was like the equivalent of having a hit movie at that. That was before the internet, before 24/7 cable, at least for the first 10 years.
Right.
So I've just had this incredible varied career that I don't know anyone else has actually gone from being kind of this radical filmmaker brand, which I embraced. Don't forget, radical doesn't just mean like out there extremist. It means getting to the root of the problem. Mm. That's the first definition in the dictionary. So I loved it.
You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have a comment on Facebook from Steve who says, I saw The War at Home in 1980. It was powerful and life-changing then. I think it's so important for people to see it now to get a perspective on taking direct action for social and political change.
Good job, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. We also have an email from Tim. My brother was sent to Vietnam, made it home okay, although never quite the same. He recommended that I not go. I went to Canada when I was 16 and registered as a conscientious objector. Big thanks to the Quakers who helped me do the paperwork. My number was 253, so I never had to go to jail. Difference was, back then, everyone, except wealthy and bone spur folks, were subject to the draft. Now, due to Reaganomics, it's only poor people who have no choice but to join, quote, volunteer armies.
Well, he's certainly right. A lot of the people who have come from some of the more depressed areas, you know, they are the ones who wind up out of necessity going into the military. And it's hard. You know, the draft is more equitable. But on the other hand, we saw when you have an unjust war like Vietnam, you know, when I came to the University of Wisconsin in 1968 as a freshman, I didn't know anything about the war. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a little bubble suburb of New Jersey. And the first day after my parents dropped me off at the university and they were so impressed with the campus and everything, they said, well, you're going to have a great education. I did, starting the next day, when someone from the Wisconsin Draft Resistance Union slipped a leaflet under my door, my dorm room door. Come, you know, to the next dorm tomorrow evening and we're going to have a meeting about the war in Vietnam. I'll never forget this. On top of the leaflet, it said, college disorientation. And when you went over there, there was 150 people in a room, all freshmen, most of whom didn't know much of anything about the war. And that began the process that changed my life, getting educated about something that is happening 10,000 miles away, but that actually does affect me. And so over time, certainly my freshman and sophomore years, you're participating because I was just one of many thousands of people kind of in the movement, so to speak, because I wanted to be participating because this did affect my life. And we did feel a moral responsibility for what our government was doing. Yeah. It seems like a novel idea these days, but it's so important. And I was so lucky to go to Madison. It was not guaranteed which way I would go, what college I would go to. It's almost like what I call chaos theory of where you wind up. And so that was really... My education was not so much in the classroom. Hmm. It was more in the movement, in the streets, coming to terms with... There's a line in the film where the 1965 president of SDS talks about how SDS, when they were one of the leaders, even though they were very, very small at that time, he said, we never tried to talk people into things. We knew we were right. We would take an action and force people to confront the situation. Hmm. And that's how you learn and have to make decisions as you're becoming a real grown-up.
Well, thank you so much for the email, Tim. Thanks for sharing that story. Let's hear from Bill, who is making a documentary called The Boys Who Said No. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Thank you for having me on.
Hi, Bill. Did you have a question or a comment?
I'll just say first hello to Glenn, and I personally will see The War at Home this evening and look forward very much to seeing that and also to seeing the question and answer. I am part of a group making another documentary film titled The Boys Who Said No about the draft resistors in the Vietnam era. Glenn mentioned Rick Goldsmith, who will be doing Q&A tomorrow night with Daniel Ellsberg over in Berkeley. Our director is Judith Ehrlich, who co-directed and co-produced a film about Ellsberg, so we have a very close connection here. Our film is not yet finished, and instead of focusing on one particular place, we focus on one particular group that arose as the war began and as the war went on. The group at first tended to burn draft cards, which was extremely controversial and bitterly opposed by media and politicians, but they felt that that was not enough, that after the draft card was burnt, everything went on as it had before.
Bill, we're almost at break. Do you have a question for Glenn about his film and about media coverage of wars?
You know, I apologize. You and I communicated briefly about email by email this morning, and
all right, Bill, why don't you let us know when your film is done, and then we'll have you on the show. Thank you for calling in. Let's take another quick call before break. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I think that the guest made a mistake when he said that when the big marches took place, that they were told that Nixon was watching football games and that was depressing. Indeed, people who have written their biographies subsequently say that he was pulling out his hair from being upset about the enormous demonstrations. So I think, to me, the lesson is when you want to do something, do it. Don't be too dependent upon how the authority figures react. They, of course, are going to say that what you did had no meaning. But if something's right to do it, then do it.
Thanks, William.
You know, I wanted to just make a comment about that. I mean, the public statement was he was watching a football game, but you may be right, in fact. But one of the things that's come out recently, we know that Lyndon Johnson was one of the most powerful presidents ever, and he was really great domestically and really awful in Vietnam. And in 1968, at the time when he was getting ready to announce that he wasn't going to run again, there were 585,000 troops in Vietnam. 585,000 troops. And then we learned 2 weeks ago from the great historian Michael Beschloss something we never knew before, that Westmoreland not only wanted more troops, we knew that, but he secretly sent a memo to Johnson asking to move nuclear weapons into South Vietnam. That's something we always feared, but no one knew that. And the fact that Johnson had to resign because of the war in Vietnam destroyed his presidency and the movement that opposed it destroyed it, and the fact that he rejected General Westmoreland's request for nuclear weapons in South Vietnam. And to my thinking, if you want them there, you're probably thinking, well, this might be one way to shorten the war, unquote. Just shows you how much power the anti-war movement had that we didn't even understand at the time. Hmm. And that this is just something that we can take away and be proud of because we kind of constrained the worst excesses that were possible at that time that we just feared and people called us paranoid. So I think that you're right. We do have to do what we have to do. We can't predict how they'll react, but I think this little story tells us we had a lot more power than we even knew at the time.
Hmm. Thank you for the call, William. Today we're joined by Glenn Silber, an award-winning filmmaker. He was twice nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary for El Salvador, Another Vietnam, and The War at Home, which has been newly restored. It opens tonight at Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco and Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley, and Glenn will be at a number of events in both cities. It also opens in other cities across the country, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call on the phone by sending an email to yourcall@kalw.org or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news with 1A, inspired by the First Amendment. 1A celebrates free speech, bringing context and insight to stories unfolding across the country. Produced by WAMU in Washington with your host, Joshua Johnson. Stay with us if you can.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Glenn Silber, an award-winning filmmaker and longtime broadcast journalist who's produced 90 primetime news magazine stories for various CBS News and ABC News broadcasts. His films, The War at Home and El Salvador, Another Vietnam, have been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. The War at Home has been newly restored. It is now playing across the country. You can find information at Your Call Radio. And if you have any questions or comments for Glenn, we're also talking about media coverage of war and what we don't really see discussed in the national media. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. When you were watching this film again, and thinking about the power of movements, like you were just talking about, the power of these students raising their voices, and they were such incredible organizers. What are your thoughts about how the media cover movements today, whether it's anti-war movements, whether it's the resistance? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, back then, in the early mid-60s and going forward, in a place like Madison, Wisconsin, the anti-war movement was a curiosity for a while. It was an unusual kind of protest that we hadn't seen, really. Even if you have to go back to the 30s, that was hard times, labor, people fighting for, you know, survival. This was very different. And so the media started showing up because it made good copy for the evening news. Okay, so you can draw a line from, let's say, 1968, 50 years later. Mm. And we've had some really bad situations. I think the most glaring example was the Iraq War, not just because of the embedded issue, but because the media just bought this huge lie yeah. about weapons of mass destruction. And it reminds me in a way of another in terms of how they cover Trump. I think in general, the media has been very strong. But don't forget, it took him almost a year to start calling him a liar mm-hmm. when everyone knew he was a liar. Well, the first feature documentary I made was actually about another demagogue, U.S. Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, because I was living in Madison, and my mentor, Emil D'Antonio, said, well, while you're making The War at Home, why don't you make this other film about the rise to power of Joe McCarthy, who came out of nowhere to beat Bob La Follette Jr., who was a very longtime progressive senator in Wisconsin. And when McCarthy finally found his big issue of so-called communists in government, people just reported it because a senator said it, that made it news, but they didn't check it out. They didn't hold him accountable. And that went on for years. The media was still kind of in its infancy in terms of investigative reporting or holding people accountable for their their lies. And of course, we've seen Donald Trump. I think they've counted as well over 4,000 lies. He tells lies every single day. But for a long time, the media was not even willing to use the lie word. I mean, why? So now I feel like with this administration, we're kind of off in some surreal landscape of politics that none of us ever saw coming, really. And it's such a destructive element, calling the press enemies of the people. Give me a break. That's what Stalin called the press. You know, so we now today are in a very tense situation where some of the mainstream organizations like CNN and MSNBC and some of the other shows are more willing than ever, because I think they're frankly scared not to, that if they somehow normalize this outrageous conduct, you know, where are we going with our democracy?
When it comes to coverage of war and military spending, for example, you know, I think about Meet the Press, which is sponsored by Boeing. Lockheed Martin advertises on a number of cable shows.
There are a number of I'm not going to speculate whether that's because of corporate sponsorship, but there are a number of mainstream shows. I'm thinking Meet the Press as well, that they put someone on and they don't really challenge them in a way that holds them accountable. The talking heads like Kellyanne Conway, whoever they put up there, they're very practiced at the art of deception, and it's not good enough. It's just like when Matt Lauer did that thing with Trump, when he let him get away with some outrageous lies in the middle of a interview that was supposed to be an important interview, and you're just sitting there as a viewer tearing your hair out.
Well, right. And Van Jones recently interviewed Jared Kushner, and it was like a love fest. I mean, it was shocking. We'll talk about that on another Friday show. But how do you analyze why we don't have in-depth conversations about war? 40 Senate Democrats recently joined Republicans to send a $717 billion military spending bill to Trump's desk. 40 Democrats. And the other day on this show, we had on Kevin DeLeon, who is running against Dianne Feinstein to represent California in the Senate. And he said something that almost knocked me over because it's so rare. He said, we need to get out of the business of bombing other countries. Such a common sense thing, but you just don't hear politicians say this.
I mean, you have to go back to Dwight Eisenhower, not exactly a liberal Democrat, who in his final speech to the country used the most important term that I've ever heard from a politician, that we as a nation had to beware, quote, of the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex. And you can go back and look at it from that point forward, and that's exactly what's happened. And so you have Congress people, because the military-industrial complex is spread in all their districts. They're so scared to stand up to them and say, we need to cut the military budget. Our military budget is probably bigger than the military budgets of the rest of the world combined. Mm-hmm. And it's just so out of whack. And yet, if you even challenge it, you're sort of called unpatriotic or whatever. The right wing will come after you. And Democrats have never been known for their courage in my lifetime, not many of them at least. Right. There have been a few. And, you know, certainly someone like Bernie Sanders, who's still an independent, I guess. But it's outrageous that we've let our country go down that path at the expense of almost everything else that was going to make us such a great country that the world admired.
How do you untangle that at this point? Because you're hearing all of these countries, except for Germany, say we're not going to stop weapon sales to Saudi Arabia because too many jobs depend on this.
We're not going to get that out of this administration, that's for sure. They haven't even really spoken out about the role of Saudi Arabia killing an American citizen, murdering him and chopping him up with a saw. So, you know, if they can't even talk about that, or when the Congress passes this Magnitsky Act, 98-2, and it describes sanctions, and, you know, Trump still poo-poos them and won't act. I can't even begin to understand or comment on the current president, because to me he's maybe the worst American I've ever encountered in any public life. And the fact that he's in the position he is to call the shots and have all of his Republican backers, who are such power-hungry, craven, you know, political know-nothings, it's just heartbreaking, you know, especially after 8 years of President Obama. I heard something that Michael Moore said recently when he was showing his film. He said, you know, we're in a bad situation now and we have to figure out how to get out of it. And right now it's all about the vote. But then he said, you know, a lot of people got really, you know, embraced hope. And he said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I can't use a dirty word on TV, but he said, hope really sucks. It's passive. Mm-hmm. I want to see action. we're not hoping for things. We're going to have to make it happen. And I think the similarity between The War at Home and Michael's recent film, Fahrenheit 11/9, is that they're both kind of fight-back films. Mm. We got to fight back. We got to do it nonviolently. We can be militantly nonviolent, but we can't ever get involved with that kind of violence again, at least as from our side, because it would just unleash a wave of repression.
You know, it's, I have to say, it's refreshing talking to someone like you who is a longtime reporter, journalist, filmmaker, who's just very honest about what we're dealing with. And I wonder, as someone who's a longtime journalist, what do you think the role of journalism is today? Because I still get very frustrated with this so-called manufactured balance, allowing Trump to really frame the story. We're going to talk about immigrants fleeing poverty and violence in a minute. He's definitely framing that story.
Well, I think the when Trump got in, people were so shocked. At first, they were saying all we're left with right now is the late night comics and the courts. But pretty quickly, at least the inside the Beltway, a core of investigative reporters started coming up with what's really going on. And I think that's important. It's not the kind of work I do, you know, having sources at the State Department or someplace else. But I really feel like they have stepped up big time, and we can be proud of what the Fourth Estate has done as far as investigating, calling out, following the Russia investigation to where it's going to go. As far as this sort of so-called even-handedness, that's one of my really arguments that I feel even Ken Burns falls into that trap. He feels he has to be overly cautious, not to be like telling it like it is. Or, you know, and that's just not my style. I mean, it's hard when I've worked at the network successfully for 20 years. I loved it because the story was what came first. They didn't think of it as a right-wing story, a left-wing story. It was just, what's the story? What's the facts? Let's tell it like it is. And if we can hold people accountable, and I've done that quite a few times, you know, that's the role of journalism. It's not to be the, you know, the PR group for one side or another. And I feel empowered by that. I loved my years there. But I just think that we still have to keep our eye on the ball. We're not the enemy of the state. We're the defenders of democracy. And that's how it is. It's called the First Amendment. Thank you very much.
Today we're speaking with Glenn Silber, an award-winning filmmaker and longtime broadcast journalist who has worked for CBS News and ABC News. He was twice nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary for El Salvador, Another Vietnam, and The War at Home, which has been newly restored. It is opening across the country. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. If you're in the Bay Area, it's playing at Landmark Opera Plaza in San Francisco, Landmark Shattuck in Berkeley, and he'll be at tonight. The screening that you'll be at is in SF, right? San Francisco?
Yeah, it's at the Opera Plaza tonight. Okay. It's a 7:30 show. And then tomorrow I'll be there for the 2:20 p.m. show, and then I'll race across the bridge and go to Berkeley for the 7 o'clock show with Daniel Ellsberg joining us on stage afterwards. And then on Sunday at 4 p.m., Connie Field will be there helping me with the Q&As. And I just love coming here because I mentioned earlier we made the film on the San Francisco Mime Troupe some years ago. And we just fell in love with the city, and the whole spirit of the counterculture here is still, I think that still lives on. You know, we won the culture war a long time ago, starting in 1968, the 50 years. But you can draw a line from that 68 period. And this is one of the things I like to talk about because I think it's missing in the narrative about resistance today. Hmm. We young people built a political culture off the seat of our pants. We didn't always know what we're doing in the 68, late 60s into the early 70s. And I think in a way we planted the seeds of resistance that are happening today. I don't know that you could have had the women's marches on that scale or come to that conclusion so quickly, those massive, massive marches, had we not had what we'd had in the late 60s and early 70s. I think even this amazing response by from the tragedy in Parkland with the kids against gun violence, you know, I don't know that those high school kids would have even thought of this type of thing had we not built that kind of political culture back in the 60s. And of course, the real legacy of the 60s is the women's movement and feminism. And we're seeing how that's playing out now, too. So I think I'd like to have that conversation because that's why it's important for these teenagers in Parkland to see The War at Home. It's important for everyone not to get too depressed about the things we're going on now because we've been in dark times, dark political times before. And so I'm really pumped up, and I'm always ready to hit the barricades one way or the other. I just feel that The War at Home has a new role to play today. It's got an act, too, And I just hope people can make it down to the cinemas, because that's where it has to start. We're going old school now. Let people know the film is back. Of course, we're going to try our best to get it back on college campuses. I'm trying to set up a screening right now, a free screening for Parkland, Florida students to see it, which would be fascinating.
That would be great.
Yeah, I'm on it. But it's hard. You know, we don't have any funding. We did a Kickstarter campaign. We're out of money now. And we're just doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Let's go to another caller, Ariane in San Francisco. Hi, Ariane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say, when we ask why do these wars continue even though most Americans are opposed to them, we have to recognize that for us to have a change in our Congress, we need to change our own attitudes and have a willingness to give up our lifestyle, because most of these wars are based on taking, pillaging, destroying cultures that are very vulnerable because we want their things. And in that sense, we give a free pass to the Congress. And we would be much healthier mentally as a culture, in a culture where 1 in 10 people are on antidepressants, if we actually understood that prosperity is something we're sharing, and love of thy neighbor, including love of people in other lands, is part of our understanding, instead of basing our society, allowing a society where gross economic disparity is the rule of the day.
Well, thank you.
Laws favor that.
Thank you so much for calling in, Ariane. Thank you for that call. Today we're joined by Glenn Silber, who is an award-winning filmmaker and longtime broadcast journalist. He's been twice nominated for an Academy Award for Best Feature for El Salvador, Another Vietnam, and The War at Home. And you can find information about the newly restored The War at Home and where it's playing across the country, yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome Sandra Cuff to the show. Sandra is a freelance journalist based in Central America, where she covers environmental, indigenous, and human rights issues. You can read Sandra's daily dispatches on the plight of Latin American refugees for Al Jazeera at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. The movement of thousands of people from Latin America has been getting wall-to-wall coverage in the United States. So much of it is in reaction to what Donald Trump says and his anti-immigrant remarks. You have been reporting from Mexico and Guatemala. Can you give us the latest? What is currently happening on the ground?
Sure. So just to clarify, it's thousands and thousands of Hondurans. So there are a few other Central Americans, but it's very specifically Hondurans. So they started fleeing their country, mainly due to violence and unemployment, some due to political persecution, but largely people cite poverty, unemployment, and violence. So they left around October 12th and crossed into Guatemala, through Guatemala and up into Mexico. So since then, you know, other people have been fleeing every single day. Hundreds and hundreds of Hondurans are leaving. A lot of people have caught up to the first group. So that's where I am now, in Chiapas, and there's sort of an estimated maybe 7,000 people here, and it's growing.
7,000?
And there are other, at least. There are also other groups still making their way up through Guatemala, and there will be a big Salvadoran caravan probably heading up at the end of this month.
You said that they left on October 12th. Today is October 26th, so we're talking 2 weeks here. Can you just talk about, you know, the grueling trek from Honduras to Mexico? I mean, what are you hearing from people? How are they doing, especially people with children and with multiple family members?
Yeah, so there are a lot of children. There are a lot of large families. There are a lot of single mothers, a lot of youth. There are also some people and children with special needs and health conditions. So because this group is so giant, you know, with the smaller groups coming up, it's sometimes easier for them to find, say, you know, a ride for like a significant distance on the back of a flatbed truck. But when you have 7,000 plus people, that's not quite so possible. So people, it's also extremely hot here. So people are setting out walking at around 3 a.m. these days. And they'll walk all day. People will find rides when they can. Some people will get up later. There are people getting rides sort of ahead of the group. So there's a giant, you know, group of thousands and thousands of people. Sometimes it's sort of little waves throughout the day. And, you know, there's little groups maybe ahead or a bit behind. But it's a mixture of walking and rides, but it's definitely a lot of walking and a lot of walking in the hot sun. So yeah, you know, people are getting really dehydrated. Luckily, everywhere along the way throughout Guatemala and in southern Mexico, towns, villages, and just, you know, random people are helping out. So in the towns where people are staying and going through here in Chiapas, the state and municipal governments have been coordinating support for days. So there's health stations, there's food, there's water, medical attention, activities for kids, etc. So it's an incredibly grueling journey, but people being met with a huge amount of support all along the way.
One man told you that he made the decision to join because there's no other alternative. He said he was overwhelmed by fear. You report that Honduras has one of the highest per capita homicide rates in the world. And you get excerpts of reasons why people leave, whether it's wanting to find a better life or if it's fleeing violence. Can you talk more about the reasons for people leaving and taking this treacherous trip up north? And in many cases, I mean, people are putting their lives on the line to make this trek.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, there has been, you know, an incredible exodus of Central Americans. It's not just happening now. So particularly from Honduras, but also El Salvador and Guatemala, for years, people have been fleeing and heading towards the United States. What makes this different now, I mean, it is also a lot of people all at once, but hundreds and hundreds of Central Americans do leave every single day. So what makes this different, and there was also a caravan earlier this year in April, May or so, who also went as a group, albeit not nearly as large as this one, is just the numbers. So it's the impact that it has for people seeing this happen, whereas usually this is happening invisibly. And so people have joined on to this group because there is a lot of danger often in the journey. You know, there can be violence, sexual assault against young women. Thousands of migrants and refugees heading up through Mexico have disappeared and been killed over the years. So the giant group really offers people sort of a collective and much safer way to travel north. But it isn't that it's all of a sudden happening. However, in Honduras particularly, you know, people do have different reasons. So poverty and unemployment is definitely one. People are struggling to be able to feed their families, to get by, to pay bills, to send their kids to school, basic things, notebooks, et cetera. You know, anybody with health conditions. I interviewed a woman today whose son has a serious immunological deficiency, and the medication, because the public health system is so basically has largely crumbled. There's been a lot of corruption scandals in Honduras. Mm. So the hospital doesn't have this medication, so she literally can't, you know, it struggles to afford to keep her son alive. So there's all kinds of reasons. Violence is definitely a main one. That same woman that I interviewed today, her husband was killed in front of her and in front of their kids. She was also pregnant at the time. So in the cities particularly, there's an incredible amount of generalized violence, also gang violence, but there's also state violence. So like I mentioned, some people are fleeing death threats and persecution. So in Honduras, things have gotten really worse since 2009. There was a military coup against the elected government, a civilian transition, but it was still a coup. The U.S. and Canada pretty quickly supported that government. Violence really spiked. Tons of people were targeted. You know, activists, land activists, protesters against the coup, et cetera, were killed. And then there had just been a lot of years. That's the year after the coup was when Honduras actually jumped to number one in the world. So it had the highest per capita homicide rate as of 2010. So, you know, there's a sort of direct timeline and consequences of these actions in Honduras, where the U.S. has had a significant role, that have really generated much more violence and impunity and political persecution and poverty for many people. That happened again last year. There were elections. A political party that grew out of the resistance movement to that 2009 coup, the party secretary is actually the president who was deposed. So they joined with other political forces to make a huge alliance to try to win the presidency from Juan Orlando Hernández, who was up for re-election, which is against the Constitution. Initially the opposition had a 5-point lead. It was expected that there was no way that could be reversed. Then the sort of tabulation and information distribution system went down for several hours. And when it finally came back on, that lead dissipated and the president was reelected. So that sparked another wave, sort of similar to the coup, but even more so, of protests and blockades for months. But since the coup, there has been a lot of militarization in the country, a new military police, really bolstered sort of military side of things versus the regular civilian police. And so dozens of protesters were shot and killed in those protests against election fraud. So, you know, when people say they're fleeing violence or they're fleeing unemployment, there's a much larger picture of what's going on in Honduras at the national level and at the international level. You know, once again, with these elections, the U.S. very actively stepped in while this was a hugely contested election in terms of the results. Like, the Organization of American States refused to recognize the winner, called for new elections, but the U.S. came in and, like, literally stood on a podium at a press conference with the Electoral Tribunal and ended up validating the results. So the U.S. has had a huge role in a lot of what's going on in Honduras.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because we're definitely not hearing that in many of the segments that are airing on radio and television in the U.S. Glenn, you made the film El Salvador, Another Vietnam. What would you add to this conversation about the importance of context in terms of history and U.S. involvement?
Well, the U.S. has a huge history of intervention in Central America. I remember reading this story in the New York Times when they basically announced the Honduran opposition had won. And then a couple days later, they said, well, maybe they didn't win, I guess. And that was another intervention. And we have a lot of bad karma down there because of supporting the School of the Americas. I worked on a film, three films on El Salvador, at a point when there had been a democratic coalition that had opposed this junta that was backed by the military. And, you know, it's just sort of tragic to see when people really believe in democracy and they stand up and they're willing to fight for it, that the U.S. government seems to always take the other side, backing the oligarchs, backing the powerful elites, backing their henchmen in the military that are pulverizing the people that have been living in a feudal state for like hundreds of years, certainly all throughout the 20th century. And so it's just so disappointing when you grow up as an idealistic young American, or any age, you expect your government to defend social and political revolutions, not be an act of repression and back the worst parties that are just willing to, in Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, previously, of course, with Somoza and Nicaragua. So I think that, you know, it's just part of what we as citizens have to be aware of, and find a way, with many of the issues we're facing, to stand up and say, we're not going to accept this. We can do better. We have to do better.
Glenn Silber is an award-winning filmmaker and broadcast journalist. His documentaries that were nominated for Academy Awards are The War at Home, which has been newly restored. Find film information at yourcallradio.org, and El Salvador, Another Vietnam. Where can we see El Salvador, or how can we see it? Just quickly.
Well, right now, it's sort of out of distribution. I've taken all my films back from distributors that weren't doing anything with them, really, and I'm getting ready to re-release them one at a time. But right now, I think The War at Home is the most important because it is directly connected to the resistance movement.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It was completely my pleasure.
Thank you. And Sandra Cuff is a freelance journalist based in Central America. Sandra, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.